And it is just a half a minute before 11 a.m. Coming up at 11 is Health Watch. Dr. David Naiman speaks with journalist Catherine Price about her book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. And at 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall hosts a conversation with Richard Arterberry, who founded the Ocean Blue Project, an effort to clean up streams and thus oceans. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And yes, you are tuned to KBOO Portland.
Taking you to faraway places.
Silence says.
And bringing them home to you.
Cha-cha-cha.
It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at kboo.fm.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is award-winning journalist and science writer Catherine Price. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, Popular Science, The Washington Post, Outside Magazine, and Best American Science Writing, among many others. A graduate of Yale University and UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, Catherine Price's previous books include 101 Places Not to See Before You Die and The Big Sur Bakery Cookbook. Catherine Price is here today on Health Watch to talk about her latest book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Welcome to Health Watch, Catherine Price.
Thanks for having me.
So, Catherine, why don't we start out with the story of how you came to be interested in writing this book? And I know it had a little bit to do with your own issues around health.
Right. So, a couple of years ago, basically what you're referring to is, when I was 22, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease that requires me to pay attention to my food in great detail, in particular carbohydrates in the food, because it affects your blood sugar. And so one day when my husband asked me kind of out of the blue, what's a vitamin? I don't know where he got that question, but he asked me what a vitamin was, and I tried to answer him, and I realized I didn't really have a good answer for him. And I just thought it was so strange, because I've written about health and food for a while now, and I think about food all the time because of type 1 diabetes, and I didn't have an answer to this seemingly simple question. So I thought it'd be interesting to look into that question and write a book about it.
So why don't you tell us what a vitamin is, and then from there we can talk about, even though people can define what a vitamin is, how little we actually know about what vitamins do.
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say is just to clarify something that was muddied in my own mind, is that the word vitamin and the word dietary supplement don't mean the same thing. So there's actually only 13 human vitamins. That's the A, C, D, E, K, and then the 8 B vitamins that go by names like thiamine and riboflavin and niacin. And those, roughly speaking, are chemicals that we need to get in very small amounts, usually from our diet, to prevent a specific deficiency. So like vitamin C prevents scurvy, for example. A dietary supplement, on the other hand, refers to a much broader category of products, including vitamins, but it's something like 85,000 different products on sale in the United States. So that includes everything from herbals and botanicals to bodybuilding powders, ground up glands, like all sorts of stuff. Everything you could see in a GNC would be a dietary supplement.
So when we're looking at vitamins, one of the interesting parts about Vitamania was you looking back at some of these diseases before we were fortifying our foods. And, you know, things like scurvy were actually huge problems, like huge amounts of mortality were happening from scurvy and other diseases that we now don't see, partially because of fortification. So can you talk a little bit about what it was like pre 20th century with some of these conditions?
Yeah, it's easy for us to forget how horrible a lot of these diseases are. and also to not be aware of how they still exist today in places that don't have as easy access to vitamins as we do. But scurvy, again, which is a vitamin C deficiency, it became a problem when people began to be able to take ships for months at a time off the coast, and so basically eat food that didn't contain any vitamin C, like basically old biscuits and stuff. It's a horrendous disease in which your body can't make collagen, which is a protein in your body that basically holds us together, and you need vitamin C to make collagen. So if you don't have vitamin C and you're not making collagen, your body kind of starts to fall apart from within, and it kills you. I mean, it's really horrible. And this was such a problem that in the age of exploration, that ship captains and the governments would count on up to 50% of their men dying from scurvy on any given voyage. But today, I mean, it's not like scurvy doesn't exist. It does exist in places like refugee camps or places where people have really, really, really poor diets. But we also have enormous problems with things like vitamin A deficiency, which is causing somewhere between 250 and 500,000 kids to go blind each year, and many of whom will die because vitamin A is important for the immune system. And we just don't really recognize that in the United States just because we are fortunate enough to have very easy access to enough vitamins that we don't see this. But these diseases will never really go away because the only way to prevent them is through good food.
So another interesting in vitamania, Catherine, is that even though people in America are mostly eating fortified food and a lot of people are taking multivitamins, we still in America are on the borderline of a lot of nutritional deficiencies. Why is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on who you talk to and how you define deficiency, but I think it's a common misperception to think that we are really all well-nourished. I was very surprised to find that actually it's quite possible in America to eat a diet that's so devoid of nutrients that you actually could risk a borderline vitamin deficiency, or even in some cases like an actual vitamin deficiency. I think the reason we don't see more of that is because there is a lot of voluntary fortification of our food supply with vitamins. But it's kind of scary to realize that if it weren't for these synthetic vitamins being added to our food, whether it's breakfast cereal or milk or orange juice or whatever, we actually could be at risk of vitamin deficiencies. I mean, at the flip side, you also have a lot of Americans who are taking so many extra vitamins and dietary supplements that they are potentially getting too much. So you have different categories of people in the States that range from people who are eating such poor diets they're really at risk of deficiencies to people who are maybe hurting themselves by taking too many of these things.
So let's split those two topics out and talk both about the reason why all of these companies are using fortification to their benefit and maybe not to ours. And then we can talk later about the second issue you raised, that just because a vitamin is good for you doesn't mean that more of a vitamin is good for you. So tell us a little bit about the double-edged sword of fortification and even multivitamin supplementation and why it's masking something around a poor nutrient-dense diet.
You know, one thing I found really interesting in my research was that there is no mandatory fortification of anything in the United States. The flour was briefly required to be enriched with things in the 40s during World War II, but now it's voluntary. You just basically, if you call flour enriched, you have to put vitamins in it, but you can sell non-enriched flour. And what I found interesting is that the idea of vitamins became so appealing to the American public that it became a great it is a great marketing term. It was made up before any vitamin was actually isolated. So food marketers got onto using vitamin to help sell their products, and as a result, it went from being something that maybe the government would have been required to mandate fortification of, you might have to fortify milk if companies weren't doing it on their own, to something that was appealing in a business sense. So the government didn't really need to worry about it as much. Companies would voluntarily put vitamins into their products. One of the reasons they started doing so in the beginning, which is like 1930s, 40s, when it became possible to add synthetic vitamins to foods, is that was the same time you start to see the real spread of packaged and processed foods that are able to sit on supermarket shelves for a long time and kind of created the modern-day grocery store. When you process a food to make it shelf-stable, which you have to do if you want to have this kind of food system, that takes a lot of the vitamins out. So in order to make sure that their products weren't totally nutritionally empty, companies started putting it back in. But now we've gotten to a point where, first of all, we don't recognize that. So a lot of times you'll see vitamins and assume a product is healthy just because it contains them without looking at the underlying basis for why that those vitamins have been added. But you also see companies using vitamins as a selling tool in ways that are totally unnecessary, like a lot of the sports drinks or energy bars or things like that that you'll find at the gym, where it's above and beyond what we would ever actually need, but it just makes us feel healthier to have lots of vitamins in a product.
Well, there's also this disconnect when you often look at epidemiological studies and say people who eat more vitamin C-rich diets tend to have less of certain diseases, for instance. But then when you mm-hmm. look at studies on vitamin C as a supplement, you don't see the same health benefits, which I would think would point to that perhaps in the diet there are all sorts of things that go along with vitamin C that we haven't identified that are actually the health-promoting benefits of those foods.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's part of it. You know, if you have vitamin C in an orange, there's a lot of other stuff in the orange besides the vitamin C that may be doing things on their own, or they may be working synergistically with the C that are not present when you just take a tablet. And then the other point would be, you know, as you pointed out, I mean, these are all observational studies, so there's a lot of potential for confounding variables. So do people who take vitamin C happen to also go to the gym more often and not smoke and exercise, you know, well, you go to the gym more often, exercise more, eat a better diet overall? It's really hard with nutrition to tease out the exact factor that's causing these health benefits or problems with health, and that is definitely true with vitamins.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Health Watch, and we're talking today to Catherine Price about her latest book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Well, why don't you talk a little bit about the research around multivitamins and why you're not a proponent of them?
Right. Well, you know, I think there is a place for multivitamins for some people. I'm just not a proponent of the idea that everyone should take them as an insurance policy, or that we should stop our questions at the question of whether to take a multivitamin. So basically, no major health organization in the U.S. recommends the routine use of multivitamins for otherwise healthy people. That's basically because they haven't been shown to cause or do much beyond what you'd get naturally from food. So there's not really much of an added benefit that we know of from multivitamins. But with that said, there's the qualifier in that sentence that it's people who are healthy who don't need to take vitamins, who are eating a good diet to begin with. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the States who are not eating a good diet, who are eating diets, you're saying, you know, that's so poor that they're actually not even getting synthetic vitamins from fortified foods. So those people might benefit from a multivitamin supplement. I would argue that it would be better first to change your food, to try to find foods that naturally contain vitamins for the reasons we were just talking about, because they probably contain other good stuff. But for those people who aren't going to do that, a multivitamin could help. But it's not, I think we want like an easy blanket answer to whether everybody should be taking one or everybody should not. And that is unfortunately not a question that has one answer.
And there's certainly certain vitamins and minerals that have more science behind them than others. I think of calcium and vitamin D and iron, for instance, for anemia, that would be slam dunk for most conventional physicians would want people to be on those for certain conditions.
Yeah, and that's an important point, that there are also specific conditions or lifestyle choices that make supplementation necessary or a good idea. So, yeah, for example, there's a reason that most flour in the United States has added folic acid to it, or enriched flour is required to have it, and that is to prevent neural tube defects, which is a devastating type of birth defect. Which means that, I mean, basically most women of childbearing age, certainly if you're even thinking about becoming pregnant, should consider a folic acid supplement, because it's hard to get enough of it to absorb enough of it from your diet, and it does do good things. Or if you're a vegan, you could have a problem with vitamin B12, because B12 is made in animals' guts by bacteria. And so if you're not eating animal products, you could be at risk of a B12 deficiency. So there's certainly times and situations where additional supplementation is medically necessary.
Well, touch a little bit on why more vitamins isn't a good idea necessarily. So why something that's potentially good for you, doubling or tripling the dose, could potentially be harmful for you in certain cases?
Yeah, this is one of the strangest things about vitamins, because we don't really apply it to most things in our life. Like, in general, you think, okay, I need a certain amount of calories, right, to fuel my body. But we all know that that does not mean that you should then eat as many calories as you possibly can every single day. That's not going to do good things for your health. But something about vitamins makes us think that if a little bit is necessary for health, then a whole lot must be better. And I think that's a unwise assumption for a number of reasons. I mean, one is that there actually have been proven issues with taking too many of particular or too much of particular vitamins. The fat-soluble ones, which are A, D, E, and K, meaning they dissolve in fat, they stick around in your body a lot longer than the other vitamins. And so it's possible to build up too much of those vitamins, especially vitamin A, which can be toxic to your liver. But you also have problems where if you take a lot of vitamins, you can throw off other processes in your body. Like you were just saying, vitamin D and calcium are intrinsically linked. And you need D to absorb calcium, and you obviously need calcium for healthy bones. So you need a certain amount of vitamin D. But if you take super doses of D over a long period of time, it's possible you could start to absorb too much calcium and end up with deposits elsewhere in your body where you don't want extra calcium, like in your kidneys. So that can be a problem. And then the other issue is just even for the water-soluble ones, which is C and the B vitamins, people just say, oh, you'll just pee them out. But yeah, you will eventually, but you really have to saturate your body before you're going to start eliminating the vitamins in your urine. And the thing is, we just don't know what the long-term effects of constantly saturating our bodies are with vitamins over long periods of time. And there is some evidence in the case of certain vitamins that could be detrimental. So I personally feel more comfortable trying to stick as closely as possible to amounts of vitamins I could naturally get from my diet.
And that goes back to kind of what you hear from Michael Pollan a lot around just going back to sort of traditional ways of eating more nutrient-dense whole foods as an insurance policy in the hope that there is a wisdom in those foods that have been passed down culturally through time. Is that somewhere that you, is that a perspective you would prescribe to or subscribe to?
Yeah, I think that it definitely is a wise way to eat. I mean, as I said, there are certain circumstances where you do need extra vitamins. In that case, they're almost functioning more like drugs or medicines, you could say, because you're correcting a problem. But I do think that that's a wise way to eat. And what I thought was interesting in my own research to kind of wrap my head around is it sounds like it's such a simplistic way to eat. But if you actually like understand how much we don't understand about nutrition, how much is unknown, suddenly the idea of eating this diet of just kind of protective foods becomes much more scientific, because you're actually acknowledging all that's uncertain and eating foods that contain the uncertainty, if that makes sense, that are the scientific cutting edge, like whatever else is in a carrot, say. But we don't actually need to understand those details in order to reap the benefits of eating these foods.
And you even look at some supplement companies that are trying to take that in terms of putting them into pills, where instead of using vitamin D, they would use a vitamin D-rich whole food that they would put in a capsule rather than the vitamin by itself.
There's a lot of activity in kind of whole food supplements and then whole food powders and stuff. That's a new trend I think is coming out. I think that, you know, it makes sense. I see where they're coming from, but I think as consumers we need to be aware that that's not the best way to get these compounds, in part because we still don't know what else you're missing or destroying if you take a whole food and put it into a pill. But also because actually they're oftentimes very expensive. I think it's interesting when people often say, oh, eating real food is too expensive, I'm just going to take supplements. And if you look at the price tags of some of these whole food powders, people are spending like $100 a month or more on pills, and you can buy an awful lot of produce for that amount of money. So I would recommend, again, whenever possible, avoiding the pills unless they're medically necessary.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if when they're saying it's too expensive, of course, sometimes it probably is, but sometimes it may just be really them saying in another way that they're not in a place where they're willing to cook.
Right. It's interesting. Yeah, because, I mean, you could say it could be too expensive for someone to buy the pills and too expensive to buy the vegetables. It just could be out of their budget regardless. But there also are a lot of people who find the room for the pills but then wouldn't do the foods. And I don't know if it's just partially we don't think about, it's so much nicer to think you could just get all the answers from a pill. And in some way we value that more than diets, so we put a different priority on it. And my takeaway from that is just that nutrition is so complicated and there are no magic answers and there is no magic pill. I mean, frankly, we're all going to get sick at some point and die anyway, regardless of what we do. But in the meantime, I keep coming back to the idea the best thing I can do is to try to get as many nutrients as I can as possible from foods that naturally contain them.
I wanted to ask you about your section on the lack of regulation around dietary supplements, which granted is a wild west of of poor regulation by any accounts. But one of the things that I had trouble following you about, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on, was holding up the pharmaceutical industry's regulation as a great example for the world for both safety and efficacy. Because we've had a lot of guests on Health Watch before talking about actually quite the opposite. And I think of, for instance, the study from Harvard and the University of Toronto that looked at 500 clinical trials and found that if a study was funded by industry, 85% of the time it would be favorable to the industry. And if it was funded by government, it would be 50%, which seems like a large difference. And similarly, like in that same study, when they looked at just 200 statin medications, 200 statin studies, there was a 20-fold difference in terms of favorability and results. And that's not even going into off-label prescribing or the fact that 30% of studies aren't published, and a lot of those are not published because of the poor results that are going to go towards industry. So what are your thoughts on corporate capitalism and the fact that a lot of these studies are really funded not by neutral scientific organizations?
Well, yeah, that's a big topic and a really interesting one. I mean, I would completely agree with you that the pharmaceutical industry is nowhere, they're not angels, and America is, I would argue, over-medicated, both in terms of drugs and supplements. So yeah, totally with you on that, and it's kind of horrifying when you realize how much of an influence basically the business interest would have on getting particular things published, and also the pressure researchers feel to put things out there that look good. I think what I would say, though, in terms of the supplements, is not that I would argue that dietary supplements should be regulated like prescription drugs. I don't actually know the precise answer, perfect answer for how we should regulate these things. But what I will say is that in the United States, dietary supplements aren't required to have those studies done to begin with. You don't have to test a supplement for safety or for efficacy before you sell it. So you don't even have the question of bias because no one is doing the studies. And to me as a consumer, that is really concerning. I mean, I'd rather have a situation where you have tons of studies and maybe many of them are biased or maybe there's lots of problems with them, but someone is actually doing the study than the situation here where I could come up with a supplement tomorrow and sell it to you right, and not have to do any research. So that's really what worries me. And as a consumer, what I'd like to see, again, I don't know the perfect regulatory path towards this, but what I'd really like is just to have some assurance that if I take a dietary supplement, it's not going to hurt me. It is going to do what it says on the label, and that it contains what it says it has on the label. And, you know, I think about something like an over-the-counter drug like Tylenol. There are problems with adulteration with over-the-counter drugs. I'm not saying that's perfect either, but for the most part, I can be pretty confident it'll get rid of my headache, and it's not going to hurt me in the dose prescribed on the label. Or the example that I think is particularly striking to me is the fact if you look at some products like antiperspirant deodorant or anti-dandruff shampoo, things we don't really think about as drugs, if you look on the back of those labels, it actually says drug facts, and there's a requirement, not that they go through like extensive tests every time you want to launch like a mouthwash, but that the manufacturers are able to cite research or match up, they call them monographs, like sets of rules that define what is mouthwash, what does it do, how do we know it's safe before they sell it. So it's a much lower standard than like a pharmaceutical drug, but it still assures you that the mouthwash is safe, and that doesn't exist for supplements either. So all that's to say that, like, I think you bring up really good points, but there's nothing protecting me from dietary supplements, and that really freaks me out.
That's a very good point and well taken. It is interesting, though, however, that you see, like, the way in which the conventional medical community, say, would look at herbs, it is the way you would expect a trade organization to look at them, in the sense that they do nothing beneficial, or if they do something beneficial, it's extremely weak, but somehow they're also extremely powerful and interfere with everything else that you're doing. And it's a very non-nuanced approach or non-herbal specific approach. It feels kind of like a convenient meme to repeat that they're going to interfere with all of your drugs and they're not going to do anything good. And there is a lot of research on a lot of these in France and Germany and England that is double-blind placebo.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I would say that you bring up a really good point about how people think about herbs and vitamins in general is that as consumers, we tend to think kind of the opposite, that they're either going to be doing good things or nothing. And both those views are wrong, because the whole reason we would take an herb is to do something, right? So, and if it's doing something, it can have side effects. Will they always be side effects that are worse than the alternative, or will they always interact with our medications in a bad way? No, I don't think so, but they could.
Sure.
So again, I would say I just want to have more of a sense that, I mean, herbs in particular, they can be very problematic in the sense that people put stuff in the herbs that aren't actually herbs. I interviewed an analytical chemist who was looking at a Chinese herbal sexual enhancement supplement, and he cracked open a vial or a capsule, and a piece of Viagra fell out. It's like an actual Viagra, and that just stuck in my mind, because it's like, wait, that's just a totally different ball game. It's one thing to ask whether that herb would have helped whatever the person was taking. Well, I guess they were taking it for sexual enhancement, whether it would have worked. But if you've got a situation where it's possible that your herb actually has a prescription drug in it, like, that just is, I don't know, mind-boggling. It really upset me.
And that's not uncommon in China, actually. I know that there was a prostate cancer herbal formula that ended up having chemotherapy in it as well.
Right, and that's what's really scary. It's like, you want to know that stuff is there.
Right.
I mean, the other thing I would say, just, I do think we tend to have a perception that it's a kind of big pharma versus like tiny organic farmers making these herbs. Again, I have plenty of complaints about big pharma, but the supplement industry in the United States is actually a $36 billion a year business. And I mean, it's enormous. So it's very much an industry itself. So I came away from this thinking, wow, we have all these very justified questions and critiques of big pharma, but what about big supplements? Because they have actually literally written the laws that have been passed by Congress that prevent the FDA from having to test these things for safety or efficacy. And they did it in the name of consumer freedom. But as a consumer, I don't really feel that free if I can't even tell if a bottle has what it says it has. So
yeah.
It's all very, I don't know, I found it very interesting to kind of rethink the way I thought about some of these things beforehand.
Well, I definitely think everybody would be behind knowing a certain level of reliability that what you're going to get in the bottle is actually the thing and nothing else.
Right, and then you can have the freedom to choose to take that.
Right, of course. So where would you point listeners to, Catherine, in terms of people who maybe have been relying on nutritional vitamin supplementation but want to move more towards a healthy diet? Are there certain diet books or cookbook books that you particularly like that you would point people towards?
You know, I think we make it too complicated. I mean, I studied with Michael Pollan, and I think his advice is just eat real, you know, eat food, mostly plants, not too much, is a great seven words or whatever of advice, and that just following that will get us a very long way. Yeah, because, I mean, you could spend a lot of money on diet books, but again, you could take that money and just make a salad with it. So my advice would basically be to try to base your diet around foods that naturally contain nutrients. And when you're talking about vitamins, that would be, you know, the things you know you should be eating, like colorful vegetables or dark leafy greens, minimally processed meats, fish. I mean, I personally eat plenty of dairy, partially because I have type 1 diabetes. But basically, try to avoid refined and processed products. Like, that's the stuff that's been really proven to have a bad effect on your health. And if you can just do whatever you can to tilt your diet in that other direction, you'll be doing good things for your health, and you don't need to stress out about it so much.
And yet the reason why I thought of the cookbook was because I think a lot of these foods, is even though the advice seems simple at the beginning, a lot of these foods people aren't used to cooking anymore.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, if you want to get, like, Deborah Madison has a lot of really great vegetarian cookbooks, if you want to do that. I mean, basically, I don't know, I think you could go to the cookbook store and, like, just browse and see what looks good, because really anything you're cooking is probably going to be better for you. And the other thing I would caution people against is getting kind of duped by food manufacturers when they add one particular dietary ingredient and try to make it seem healthy. This originally happened with vitamins, where you'd have like vitamin enriched something like a donut or something, and then it's sold as healthy, but it's actually still a donut. But I just got back from a huge natural food industry trade show this weekend, in which there was a huge, huge exhibition hall of thousands and thousands and thousands of supposedly healthy foods. And now the things that are being put in are like chia seeds or like hemp or,
right.
I don't know, there were lots of like
all
nut
the
butter.
Superfoods.
I'm fine with nut butter. Yeah, all these superfoods. And just be aware that adding chia seeds to a muffin doesn't change the fact that it's a muffin. I think it's very easy for us to get so interested in the super element that we forget to actually evaluate the underlying food.
Well, thanks for coming on Health Watch today, Catherine. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking today to Catherine Price, author of Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. This is Health Watch. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for qualified candidates to fill two vacant board seats. The KBOO Board of Directors invites qualified KBOO members who are interested in becoming a board member to submit a candidate statement no longer than 500 words, which should include the applicant's experience, information about previous board or coalition experience, and why they want to serve on the KBOO Board of Directors. Please email your candidate statement to Timothy Welp at kboocommunity@gmail.com by March 13th. 2015. Candidates should also plan on being present at the March 23rd, 6 p.m. KBOO Board of Directors meeting to present a short statement about why they are interested in joining KBOO Board of Directors.